A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 hello. And welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart and with me is Gary Bain. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Pete. Are you going to be with somebody else 1 week?
I hope so. Change is as good as the rest. We're here recording at my gaff because it was going to rain. So Gary's driven all the way here instead of me walk to it. Right. What are we doing today, oh maestro?
Well, today, Pete, it's the second part of the Eddie Rickenbacker, Edward V. Rickenbacker.
Wow.
And this part I've called Seagulls.
Oh.
And it will become apparent as to why, unless you know about his life story, in which case you already know. Now, in the last podcast, we left Captain Rickenbacker touring the United States promoting Liberty Bonds in a rather imaginative way, by speaking complete nonsense, on behalf of the US government.
Now, following his discharge from the United States, say the US Air Force, whatever it is.
USAAF.
Was it called that then?
I called it then.
And prior to forming the Rickenbacker Motor Company, Rickenbacker undertook a number of promotional activities. What's he trying to do there?
Well, he's trying to generate public and governmental enthusiasm for the potential of airplanes, but unfortunately he had limited success.
Now, in 1920, 1921, he made 4 transcontinental crossings, during which he had...
Yes. He had 7 crashes, 9 near misses, and 8 forced landings. Now, we're emphasising, we tried to do this right from the start, Pete. He seems somewhat accident-prone, but a very lucky individual. He seems to survive these things.
Lucky Eddie, they call him. Yeah. They're being informal, of course.
Now, the Rickenbacker Motor Company, that started in 1920.
What was that involved with?
Well, they designed a car which took 2 years and 100,000 miles of test driving before it was unveiled at the New York Auto Show in 1922.
Now, it's marketed a car worthy of its name, i.e. Rickenbacker. And it's also I would imagine controversy at the time, utilises the hat in the ring squadron symbol. What is the hat in the ring squadron symbol? Just remind our listeners, Gary.
It's a ring with a hat in it. The clue's in the name. Now, it was a high quality mid-price car described as up to the minute in every detail. And as you'll find out shortly, it was. They sold for between $1,500 and $2,000.
Now, thanks to the, and I'd better take this bit because it's a bit complex for you.
You need to describe this for me.
Yeah, because it had, Gary, an innovative tandem flywheel at the rear of the crankshaft.
Now, that significantly reduced vibration.
Well, it would, Gary, it would.
It would.
I mean, it would. Think about it.
Now, it was...
Wouldn't you, if you had a crankshaft...
It was selected to make the first transcontinental radio tour in 1922, and the following year, its smooth ride was celebrated in the popular song In My Rickenbacker Car by Leo Wood, which was alternatively entitled, which I much prefer, Crackerjacker Rickenbacker.
Crackerjacker Rickenbacker.
Now, we have no idea how this song goes, dear listener.
Or of the lyrics, but you've written some for us, haven't you?
We're going to have a go at our own lyrics. So, after 3, Pete. 1, 2, 3.
In my Rickenbacker car, in my Rickenbacker car, I sit in the front seat in order to drive. I lay on the back seat when I want to skive. And thanks to a seagull, I'm very much alive in my Rickenbacker car.
Well, what a treat that was.
The listeners all over the world are switching off. Yes. Now, in September 1922, Rickenbacker marries, doesn't he? And he marries Adelaide Frosternat.
Yeah, she was the former wife of one of his many racing rivals. And although they were both in their 30s, and in fact she was 5 years older than him, their marriage was a happy one that lasted 51 years until Rickenbacker's death in 1973.
So they lived happily ever after.
Sort of, yes.
I'll just another clue to the ending there. Now, in 1923, following his marriage, Rickenbacker decides to make the Rickenbacker Motor Company public, and he prices the shares at an imaginative $11 each. So the sale was promoted by a statement extolling the virtues of Eddie Rickenbacker. Ooh, who else did it extol?
Well, and his management team. Although I do actually wonder who they were trying to convince. And this is the statement which you are going to read eloquently.
The management of the Rickenbacker Motor Company is composed of pioneers in the industry. And although young in years, this company is in reality one of the oldest from the standpoint of management. The past record of successes made by each and every official inspires confidence. And we believe stock in the Rickenbacker Motor Company offers safety in every way that men of proven ability and integrity can devise to safeguard your interests and their own.
So he'd moved to Australia, Eddie.
He moved to Australia temporarily.
That was awful.
How do Americans speak?
I don't know. Not like that. Now,
never mind.
A mid-year introduction of four-wheel brakes, which was an innovation that was born from a system that he'd actually benefited from when he was on the racetrack a decade earlier, that was costly, and the delays contributed to difficult sales conditions.
Well, I was wondering, because when you said it was a high quality mid-price car, there is an element of high quality tends to cost money, mid-price.
And also think about when this was, you know, what could be round the corner?
Oh, was it that Henry Ford?
Now, another mid-change in 1924, mid-year change, sorry, left the dealerships feeling mistreated and they had to take on additional costs.
What, you mean they changed the car? Yeah.
They kept changing things. And despite these difficulties, the Rickenbacker Model 8 was the fast car in the 1925 Indianapolis 500.
No idea what any of those words meant.
Well, the Indianapolis 500 is a 500-mile race, and it's an endurance race, I presume, which means that, you know, that car, it was a good car.
Now, does he abandon aviation then for cars? Because that was his original career, of course.
No, he doesn't. He continues to work in aviation, but you might want to ask whether he should have been concentrating on the Rickenbacker Motor Company, given the problems it was experiencing. The introduction of the less expensive and equally reliable Chrysler, that cut into...
Actually, it wasn't Ford, it was Chrysler.
No, and that cut into their market, making a difficult trading environment even harder. And in December 1926, Automotive Industries magazine reported...
Will this be your American?
This will be my American accent. Operating under a temporary and friendly receivership, the lately reorganised company... I'm from Boston, apparently they sound English... is now in production on the new models. During the month of December, between 300 and 400 new cars will be shipped, and plans call for the production of 500 a month for 1927. According to Rickenbacker officials, their dealership organisation has remained intact during the reorganisation period, and all dealers are now in possession of the new line of cars. The company expects to settle its $500,000 indebtedness and terminate its receivership within 6 months. Friendly receivership.
Is somebody lying?
Yeah, I've never heard of a friendly receivership.
Have you been in receivership in any of your many careers?
You've received me on a number of occasions.
That's rude and not true.
Now,
for our listeners, take umbrage.
This view proved to be fatally optimistic, and the company went bankrupt in 1927.
So it was only about for 5 years.
Now, despite not being legally responsible for the debt, Rickenbacker considered repaying the $250,000 that had been loaned to him a matter of personal honour, and he actually eventually repaid the full amount.
Yeah, probably when interest and various things had reduced it to almost nothing.
But well, possibly.
It's more honourable than most businessmen.
Now, the design of the car, that was also justified, as all American-made cars soon afterwards had the four-wheel braking system, which was introduced by the Rickenbacker Motor Company in 1924.
Now, we were talking about aviation, and you said he did carry on, you know, when he should have been concentrating on the motor company, I suppose. So what's he up to in the air, up high?
Well, he tried to achieve speed and distance records, as well as trying to develop a light plane that would be affordable for private ownership. And in 1923, so a little bit earlier, he announced the Glider Trophy, which was a worldwide contest to be held annually to encourage experimentation in glider design. The trophy alone cost $5,000 to produce.
Now, that... I mean, he does seem to be not entirely grounded in business affairs to me.
Well, he does seem to be a bit of an entrepreneur, doesn't he? He likes to do things,
but not grounded.
But, yeah, perhaps.
Especially with his glider. They often ground.
Now, in 1925, although he was no longer in the army, he appeared as a defence witness at the court-martial of the former Brigadier General Billy Mitchell.
Wasn't he in charge of the United States Air Force, as he was?
In France during the Great War, yes, for a period. And he was charged for insubordination because he constantly criticised the failure of the army to implement a full-scale aviation programme.
He was insubordinate.
He was, and that's why they charged him with it. Now, as you mentioned...
He was right, though.
Yeah, he was, and later proved right. Now, as you mentioned, he served in France during World War One, and by the conflict's end, he commanded all American air combat units in that country.
Not in Belgium?
Not in Belgium, nor in Lowestoft.
Belgium? That was a trick question. Right, so now, so Rickenbacker, the great ace of aces, the American aces, that would clear his name, would it?
No, despite his testimony and that of many others like him, Mitchell was found guilty. Rickenbacker was far from pleased. And actually, this was reported in the press at the time.
Now, you said he had an entrepreneurial nature.
I never said that. That's far too long a word.
Yes, it is quite a word. I was struggling with it for a while, but I got through it, I felt. In 1926, he starts something else. What's his start then?
Well, I think you're referring to Florida Airways, which he started with his fellow Great War pilot, Reed Chambers.
Never heard of him.
Now, other investors of note, who you may have heard of, included such luminaries as Henry Ford, and his investment included the supply of 3 new aeroplanes, and Percy Rockefeller, who was the nephew of John D. Rockefeller, the co-founder of Standard Oil.
The famous rich people of legend.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now, the airline started to carry mail in April 1926, and passenger services began 2 months later, travelling between Miami and Jacksonville. What happened to Florida? Did they boom or bust?
Well, it was a victim of the crash of 1926. As I mentioned earlier, he's trying all these things at a period in time that we now know, with hindsight, was going to be difficult. And he also suffered because of a decline.
Property boom collapsed, didn't it? Yeah.
And he fell into receivership within a year. So that's 2 setbacks, corporate setbacks in quick succession. But despite this, 1927 saw him purchase the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for $700,000.
I want to just say that he seems to have...
That's a lot of money.
He seems to generate quite a lot of money.
And this was reported...
Is he one of these chaps who loses other people's money?
And this was reported by the Associated Press. A group of businessmen headed by Edward V. Rickenbacker of Detroit, America's greatest ace in the World War, and formerly an automobile race driver, today purchased a large share of the stock in Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Rickenbacker was named president of the organization, which in the future will be known as the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Corporation.
That was brilliant. This does well. This is something he can run. He seems to do well at this, and he runs it successfully, doesn't he? And until he sells it after the Second World War, so we can put that aside in a way. But it's not all he's doing. What else is he doing?
Well, he's not content with just being the owner of a racetrack. He also kept the job that he'd had with General Motors since 1921, as well as a number of airplane manufacturers who he worked for. And in 1929, he convinced General Motors to purchase Fokker Aircraft Corporation of America.
Hang on, I've heard that name before.
Yeah, it was part-owned by the famous designer of the scout planes that he'd once faced on the Western Front, which includes Belgium.
Are you saying he used to fight Fokkers?
He did. Now, in the years that followed... glided. Oh, see what I did there? In the years that followed, Rickenbacker became involved in a number of aviation companies, moving away from General Motors before returning in 1933 following their purchase of North American Aviation, where he was appointed as Vice President for Public Affairs.
They're using his name, aren't they? Rickenbacker publicly criticised President Roosevelt and his New Deal, and when President Roosevelt rescinded the existing mail contracts that were held by private airline companies and moved it to the US Army Air Corps in 1934. So, good idea to criticise Rickenbacker, Roosevelt, do you think?
No, as it transpires, Rickenbacker, who was at that time Vice President of Eastern Air Transport, guess what? One of the private companies that were impacted by this, he described Roosevelt's New Deal policies as little better than socialism. And following the deaths of several inexperienced and undertrained army pilots in crashes, he called it legalized murder.
How did that go down with Roosevelt?
Well, as a result, the Roosevelt administration that ordered NBC Radio to ban Rickenbacker from their programs.
Yeah, I like that. Down to that, Roosevelt.
Yeah, he was around for a while, wasn't he? Now, in early 1935, he becomes Rickenbacker, not Roosevelt, general manager of Eastern Airlines. And in 1938, after he'd learned that General Motors was considering selling Eastern, he met with their chairman of the board, Alfred P. Sloan, and bought the company for $3.5 million.
Now, under his stewardship, I mean, the company prospers, doesn't it? It grows from one flying a few thousand miles a week into a proper major airline, if you like. What else does he do?
Well, he negotiates mail contracts with the US government.
I thought he was barred.
As well as developing new aircraft designs. He also purchases faster and larger aircraft, including the four-engined Lockheed Constellation and the Douglas DC-4.
I think that's a famous aircraft. Yeah, that's a famous transport aircraft
from the
Second World War. Now, he does something else, and this tickled my fancy, Gary. What is it?
Well, it's rather bizarre, but he scripted a popular Sunday comic strip called Ace Drummond, which I think I've heard of, from 1935 until 1940.
Yeah, it's made into a film series, one of those... Saturday morning shorts, I suppose. Oh, might not have been, might have been longer. Also a radio programme as well as a book. We've got a book, haven't we, Gary? What's our book called?
Laugh or Cry.
When you work with me, it's one or the other.
Now, getting back to the point, easily distracted, Pete. During this time, he was also involved in another comic strip called The Hall of Fame of the Air, which was a fact-based comic that featured airplanes and air battles of famous aviators and aces.
Oh. Do you actually think he wrote those pieces, or do you think he just gave his name to it? You don't know, do you?
But we don't know, but his name certainly added a certain authenticity to the comic strip.
So he was, he's being paid for his name probably, but he might have written it. We don't know, do we?
We don't. Now, in spite of his love for flying, Rickenbacker never actually used the word safe about it.
After his experiences, I'm not surprised.
And he's actually been quoted as saying this, and you're going to tell us what Edward V. Rickenbacker said.
I never like to use the word safe in connection with either Eastern Airlines or the entire transportation field. I prefer the word reliable.
Now, there's a good reason for this, because on the 26th of February 1941, he was in a Douglas DC-3 that crashed in the woods near Atlanta, Georgia.
Now, after the impact, he's pinned down under the wreckage. He's soaked in aviation fuel, and he's coming in and out of consciousness. So, what does he do?
Well, when he's not unconscious, he devotes his time to encouraging those around him to fight for their survival, including those that would subsequently not live long enough to actually be rescued. Now, he recalled the training he'd received during his service, and he instructed those able to walk on how to go about finding help.
Now, this was summed up by a chap called David Lee Russell, who wrote a book, Eastern Airlines, A History, 1926 to 1991. And he describes the predicament Rickenbacker finds himself, because he's absolutely buggered, isn't he? I mean, it's a technical term.
Of the survivors, Rickenbacker was in the worst shape. In the crash, he was jammed into the seat arm, which fractured his left hip socket and pelvis on both sides. He had three ribs broken, two of them protruding through his skin on his side. His knee was broken, his left elbow was crushed, and his skull was dented. The survivors suffered for hours in the cold, since the rescue team did not reach the crash site until 6:30 a.m., just before dawn. Rickenbacker was poured from the jagged metal between a bulkhead and a fuel tank. I mean, can just think about that for a minute. What a state he's in.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting that he wasn't in the worst state, seeing as some of them died, but, you know.
Now, the rescuers don't
that's
hold
probably
out.
Some hyperbole.
Hyperbole or hyperbole. The rescuers didn't hold out much hope for him, and this is his aide, John Haliburton, remembering.
I wouldn't have given a plug nickel for his living another 24 hours. One eye was hanging out of its socket all the way down to his cheekbone. We put Eddie on a stretcher with a defective catch. I could still remember him cursing, even though he was only semi-conscious. Some bastard of a newspaper photographer shoved a camera in his face as we got him on the stretcher, but he never got a chance to snap a picture. Someone from Eastern, I don't know who, damn near knocked the gut off the bridge where the plane hit. The git, I think that might be. I'm not sure. Anyway, he hit him anyway, didn't he?
I'm not sure an American would call him a git.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Why would he call him a gut?
Maybe he was quite a large chap. Now, David Russell, he details what happened next. Rickenbacker and the other injured were taken to Atlanta's Piedmont Hospital on Capitol Avenue. When an intern saw Rickenbacker, he remarked, "He's more dead than alive. Let's take care of the live ones." Seeing his mangled body, a Catholic priest offered to give him last rites, but he refused it. Dr. Floyd McRae, the head surgeon, arrived and started working on Rickenbacker. With his eye back in its socket, the next morning McRae made sure his patient got a milkshake laced with brandy. But Rickenbacker responded, "I want a bottle of beer and ham and egg sandwich." McRae produced six bottles of beer, but lied to reporters that he gave Rickenbacker Coca-Cola. The Coca-Cola company sent Rickenbacker a refrigerator filled with the soft drink.
It pays to advertise. And Coca-Cola, it's a very refreshing drink, isn't it, Gary?
Yes, it revives you, doesn't it? If you're not feeling very good, a whole fridge worth would be fantastic.
It would. And also, I'd just like to say that brandy is also quite nice and we really like beer.
Wow. We're going to be inundated.
Inundated, our sponsors. Right. It's not funny. This crash, though, is a terrible event. I mean, it is, isn't it? Eight people are killed. They lose their lives in the aftermath of the crash. And how long was Rickenbacker in hospital?
Well, he was there until the 25th of June, 1941. But he did actually...
So that's the best part of 4 months.
Yeah. But he did actually resume work, and he made the hospital room a kind of office, and actually he even held meetings with the executives of the company by his bedside. So it's like board meetings around his bed. Now, ultimately, the cause of the crash was recorded as pilot error, although Eastern were heavily criticised for a lack of proper cockpit procedures. Now, at this point, we'll take a short break.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back. Now, during the period leading up to World War II, Rickenbacker supported the isolationist movement.
Now, what's that?
Well, it's keeping America out of the war, isn't it?
Yeah, because the war, of course, was raging since 39 in Europe.
Yeah. But he officially left the America First organisation in 1940. He'd been a member for a few months.
He then adopts a very pro-British position, doesn't he? It's what he describes as Britain's heroic resistance to relentless air attacks. The Luftwaffe pounding London and all
that.
He's
referring to the Battle of Britain, isn't he, in 1940. Now, he was convinced of the need for American involvement, and he actually wrote, and you're going to tell us what he wrote.
"Should these gallant British withstand the terrific onslaught of the totalitarian states until the summer of 1941, it is my sincere... sincere conviction that by that time this nation will have declared war." In actual fact, they don't, do they?
No, they do, following the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, so the end of 1941.
They do come in. And
they're once more at war.
Yeah. Can Rickenbacker be seriously involved? Well, he is one way and another, but how old is he by this time?
Well, he's in his 50s, and it's too old to fly combat missions. But the US government, they've got every intention of utilising his unique skills.
He does have a fair amount of skill. He's got an interesting skill set, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has, but he's also got an airline. And in 1942, he pledged Eastern Airlines equipment and personnel for use in military activities. Under his instruction, the airline flew munitions and supplies across the Atlantic to the British, and he himself, armed with a letter of authorization from the US Secretary of War, visited Britain in an official capacity where, along with making recommendations for war operations, he actually inspected troops, operations and equipment.
This is a publicity role, but it's also increasing support amongst both civilians and soldiers, American and British, of course. I mean, he's a popular man.
He is, but he also does other things. He later worked with both the US Army Air Force and the RAF on bombing strategy, which included working both with Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Harris and General Carl Andrew Spatz, who was later to be appointed as Commander of Strategic Air Forces in Europe. I'm not quite sure what his input would have been on bombing strategy.
Yeah, it may be that he we'll see. Well, we won't see, because we don't know. He'd reached middle age. Suppose there's not much excitement left, is there, Gary, in this podcast? He's had enough of, adventure, thrills and spills, more spills and thrills and spills and thrills to last a lifetime. But there's something lying ahead, isn't there? Something really dramatic. And this is why you, Gary Bain, of whatever your address is, I better not tell him that or they'll be round to knock your fence down. You wanted to do a second podcast about this incredible man, because there's something amazing coming up, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, this is from an article in 2004 for World War II magazine, and it was written by one Billy Ray, which is a great American-sounding name. And he explains, in late 1942, Secretary of War Henry Stimson and Army Air Force's Chief of Staff General Henry H. Happ Arnold asked the 52-year-old airline executive to travel to the Pacific Theatre as a $1 a day non-military observer. Rickenbacker was accompanied on the mission by his aide, a Colonel Hans Adamson.
Did he get a dollar a day as well?
Probably more. On October the 20th, 1942, they climbed aboard a well-worn Boeing B-17 in Hawaii. The B-17 was crewed by Captain William Cherry Jr. of Abilene, Texas, who was the pilot, Lieutenant James Whittaker of Burlingame, California, who was the co-pilot, Lieutenant John DeAngelis of Nesquehoning, Philadelphia, who was the navigator, Private John Bartik of Freehold, New Jersey, who was an engineer, and Sergeant James Reynolds of Fort Jones, California, who was the radio operator. Now, also along was Staff Sergeant Alexander Kazmarchik from Torrington, Connecticut, who was an enlisted airman who was returning to his outfit in Australia after recovering from a lengthy illness. They finally took off at 1:30 a.m. on the 21st of October, bound for Canton Island, about 1,800 miles to the southwest.
Now, this B-17D Flying Fortress strays hundreds of miles, of course, and it runs out of fuel. You can't just wander about the Pacific. It's too big. What do you do if you run out of fuel? You have to ditch in the sea, that splashy thing. Billy Ray goes on to say in his article,
Rickenbacker stuffed a map, some official papers and his passport into his coat pockets. He also grabbed several handkerchiefs and a 60-foot line. When the rafts were inflated and free, the pilots exited through the forward hatch and lent a hand to the passengers. Rickenbacker's escape hatch was above a wing, so he helped the others climb out once he was outside the plane. The swells were well over 6 feet high, making the rafts extremely difficult to handle.
Now, some of the men, they stripped down to the underwear because they thought they'd have to swim for the rafts. Others, kept the clothes on. And that, now, what else have they got? What have they managed to get off the Flying Fortress?
Well, in addition to the rope, they also had a first aid kit, a very pistol with 18 flares, two hand pumps, which were used for bailing out water and pumping air into the raft.
Very sensible.
Two sheath knives, a pair of pliers, a small compass, two collapsible bailing buckets, some patching gear for each raft, pencils, as well as the map Rickenbacker had grabbed.
Now, Sergeant Reynolds had grabbed two fishing lines, but they didn't have any bait. Now, the pilots had kept their pistols, so they were armed. They could cope with any mutiny on board the rafts.
Now, they settled back exhausted into the rafts, and they were suffering from a combination of both exertion and stress. Now, who was in the worst condition, Pete?
Well, that would be Kamarzik, because, as you will remember, he'd recently been discharged from hospital. There's one thing that they'd been foolish about, hadn't they?
Yeah, in their scramble to escape the sinking aircraft, they'd not recovered even one flask of water or an emergency ration box.
And Edward V. Rickenbacker, I bloody hate V's.
Vernon.
Edward Rickenbacker to me.
Eddie.
No, he says this. "We're going to need that water," somebody said. "Let's go back and get it." "Don't be a fool. That plane's going to sink any second. You'd never find the water and rations anyway. They're all sloshing around underwater." Sloshing, sorry. "Anybody who's in that plane when she goes down will go right down to the bottom with it." And so we decided not to try to get the water and rations out of the plane. That was another mistake. The ship stayed afloat. He means the aeroplane. For almost 6 minutes. Well, I'm not sure that was enough time, but there you go. Then slowly the tail swung up and poised gracefully for a split second. And then the ship went down. As I say, he means the aircraft.
Now, the unrelenting Pacific sun...
You're getting poetic again, Gary.
Began to burn.
You mean it's hot?
It's very hot. Those that had removed their clothing...
Never remove your clothing, Gary.
They began to suffer.
Now, Rickenbacker is watching as Sergeant Reynolds, who'd taken his clothes, he goes pink, then red, and then he begins to blister. And if you think of it, the unrelenting sun, no shelter for hour upon hour upon hour. What happens to the others? Same thing.
Those that are taking their clothes off, they're also going to blister. Now, Rickenbacker...
What? Is he...
He's wearing a civilian suit.
In his undies?
No, he's fully clothed in a civilian suit, and he's also got a battered fedora hat on. And so he's relatively protected. But the salt water that, as you say, sloshes about in the raft,
yeah,
that caused sores all over his body.
Well, that's the prolonged exposure to it, isn't it?
It is. And he later recalled his and his comrades' predicament.
There followed 5 days of calm. It was beastly hot. There was no rain until the 8th night. We saw nothing in the way of searching planes or ships. The boy in my boat had a Bible in the pocket of his jumper. On the second day out, we organised prayer meetings in the morning and in the evening. Frankly and humbly, we prayed for our deliverance. After the oranges were gone, there showed up terrible pangs of hunger. Then we prayed for food. I didn't hear any mention of oranges before.
No. Now, it's at this point that something so unbelievable happened that Rickenbacker later admitted...
If it wasn't for the fact that I had 7 witnesses, I wouldn't dare tell this fantastic story. Carry on.
Well, they'd prayed for a miracle, and on the afternoon of the 8th day, following one of their prayer meetings... they were attempting to have a nap when they received one.
A miracle?
Yeah. Rickenbacker, he'd leaned back against the side of the raft and he pulled down his hat over his eyes. All he could hear was the gentle lapping of the waves against the raft. Now, suddenly, Rickenbacker felt something land on the top of his hat.
What was it, Gary? What was it?
It was a seagull.
So what does he do?
Well, he sat perfectly still while he sort of planned his next move.
I can imagine it.
Now, with a flash of hand and a squawk from the seagull, he managed to grab the bird and wring its neck.
Now, he tears the feathers, he plucks the bird, and then he and his starving crew made a small meal.
There's eight of them.
The two rafts are obviously adjacent, very adjacent. There wouldn't be much
I think there's 3 rafts.
There wouldn't be many, much to eat.
No, but afterwards, they're able to use the intestines of the seagull for bait.
And they had those fishing lines.
Yeah, and with that, they caught fish, which in turn gave them more food and sausages. More bait.
Oh, right.
And so the cycle of their luck continued.
They'd have been even luckier if they'd had sausages.
And once more, this is Billy Ray in the World War II magazine of 2004. Late that same afternoon, the sky turned cloudy. The wind took on a different feel, and for the first time, the prospects for rain looked promising. About 3 a.m, raindrops fell for a few minutes, and they spotted a squall not far away. They paddled towards it, praying that they could get in its path. There was already a plan in place for such an occasion. They would catch rain on handkerchiefs, shirts and socks spread out over the rafts. Adamson even removed his shorts. It's always one. The squall turned into a driving rainstorm and all hands did what they could to collect water. Rickenbacker was designated his raft's ringer as the clothing became soaked. He twisted the water into a bucket.
I wouldn't want the short water.
No. After the storm subsided, the men agreed to ration the water sparingly, a half jigger per day per man.
I don't know what a jigger is.
It was the sweetest water they'd ever tasted.
Oh, I'm ruined.
Especially the ones from the shorts.
I ruined that last elegant quote. So there was eight of them. Did they all survive?
No, it's not enough to save Kazmachik, who drank seawater whilst suffering from dehydration. He died after they'd been adrift for 2 weeks.
Hang on, so that the eighth night it rains, so there's another 6 days, another basically week.
And they buried him at sea.
Now, what's going on in the background? This is the greatest ace of World War One, or the Great War, as we would call it. He's missing. So what are the authorities doing?
Well, the US Army Air Force...
Are they searching? Are they?
And the US Navy. They planned to stop searching.
So they were searching.
After just about 2 weeks.
Ah, I've just remembered another thing from previously. They weren't where they were supposed to be.
No.
They were madly off course.
They were. Now, Rickenbacker's wife persuaded them to search on for another week. And... back at home during this time, the newspapers and radio reports were stating that Rickenbacker and his crew were already dead.
So what do the boats do?
Well, the survivors split up. Cherry rowed off alone in the small raft and was rescued on day 23. Reynolds, De Angelis and Whittaker, they found a small island that was close to
an inhabited island.
Yeah, where the natives were hosting an allied radio station, which is rather
handy.
Fortunate.
Yeah.
And a float plane rescued Rickenbacker, Adamson and Bartek on the 13th of November 1942.
That's 24 days. I've just worked that out in my head.
Yeah, it also says it in the notes. Now, all were suffering from exposure, sunburn, dehydration, and actually near starvation.
Yeah, we've got to remember, though they're fishing, it's not exactly a lot to eat. And they wouldn't be able to cook anything, so it'd be all raw. Sushi.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, they were lost for a total of 24 days, and the survivors were taken to a Navy medical base at Samo. And in the end, all of the men make it home.
Except for?
Kazmachinchik.
Not quite as good as the previous effort. So is that the end of the story? I mean, that's just an amazing story. And let's be honest, it's the reason you wanted to do this additional podcast, because it is just such a great story.
It's an amazing
man. Survival and just what, and it happened to the greatest American ace of the war. I mean, what of the First World War?
And for the rest of his life, he would apparently quietly go away and at the coastal areas where there were seagulls and things and thank the seagulls. It's bizarre.
So, went a bit loopy, didn't
he? Now, Rickenbacker was determined to continue to support the war effort. And in 1943, following his own suggestion that he undertake a fact-finding mission to the Soviet Union, he was going to go to provide assistance to the Soviets with technical assistance with their American-supplied aircraft, he approached Soviet diplomats rather than official American channels.
Well, there must have been some official channels, because Stimson, that's the chap...
Secretary of State for War.
He gets permission, and he's signed to visit the Russian Soviet bases and production facilities. And he goes, and actually he goes everywhere. Doesn't he
goes
he?
On a bit of a tour, doesn't he? He goes to the Aleutian Islands.
It's not just the Soviet Union, no. Is it?
Burma, China, India, the Middle East, North Africa, and then the Soviet Union.
Now, the War Department, they provide everything that Rickenbacker needed, including an unusual, very unusual letter. What's it say?
Well, it gives the bearer permission to visit any areas he may deem necessary for such purposes as he will explain to you in person. And that was signed by the Secretary of War, Stimson.
I need to visit this bar.
Yes.
And that brothel.
Now, Rickenbacker began his trip in April 1943, travelling first to Cairo.
So that's only, that's a five months after, no, yeah.
He travels first to Cairo in a US Army Air Force C-54 and from there on to India.
I wonder if he was nervous about flying. No, I shouldn't think so. He never got nervous in all the other crashes and, yeah.
He made detailed reports on every stop and including an unfavourable report on the hump airlift. What's when he returned that, yeah. To the USA. It's an airlift with a hump. And he travelled on to China, Iran, and from there to the Soviet Union.
Now, he's looking round, and he's, well, wartime conditions of the Soviet Union, and he notices, the one thing he does notice is the determination, the patriotism of the Russians. He notices something else that's a little less savoury, because determination and patriotism are fine. What else does he notice?
Well, the Russians had a policy of denying food to those deemed to be unproductive to the war effort.
That's harsh.
It is. Now, while he's there, he does what he's there to do. He shares the required knowledge of the American supplied aircraft, and he does make several friends amongst the Soviet officials. They lavishly entertain him, and he later recalled attempts by the NKVD agents, so that's the
Soviet Secret Service,
to get him intoxicated enough to disclose sensitive information. He'd largely tell them about seagulls, I suppose.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a lot of... And then when you need a seagull... I wonder, do you think if the NKVD attempted to get you lavishly entertained and intoxicated, they'd be... They'd get any information out of you?
No.
It certainly wouldn't get any sense out.
They'd get it before lavishly entertaining me. Now, although his mission's successful, when he gets back to America, he's not greeted with, you know...
What was the name of that president?
President Roosevelt. He didn't meet him. And although Rickenbacker's later awarded the Medal of Merit for his support of the war effort by the United States government. So there's no official recognition when he returns until he gets that medal.
Yeah, I wonder if that's after Roosevelt was dead. Let's move on, because to be honest, this is all an excuse to get to the seagull. But it's not the end of Rickenbacker, is it? Because it's not.
No, I mean, this really is a departure for us, this podcast. But, you know, it's trying to recognise this man had several lives. You know, he was a racing driver, a scout pilot, an entrepreneur, and latterly, a very, very, very successful businessman.
And a very, very, very lucky man.
Yes, or unlucky, because he kept finding himself in these situations. Now, following the war... Rickenbacker set out to make Eastern Airlines the leading commercial carrier in the United States.
And for a while, it was the most profitable airline in the, you know, in the post-war years. What happens in the 1950s? Does it carry on being successful?
Well, in the late 1950s, its fortunes declined.
More competition, I would imagine.
I would think so. And Rickenbacker himself, he's forced out of his position as CEO on the 1st of October 1959.
And he resigns furthermore as chairman of the board. But then he's 73, which is fair enough, on the 31st of December 1963. No need for such a precise date, I personally feel, but you know.
Now, he published his autobiography in 1967, which was simply entitled Rickenbacker, and that was the primary resource for this second podcast.
And we recommend that you read that, because it's a rattling good read. You enjoyed reading it, because you did a lot of the work on this.
I did enjoy
it. When I say lot of, I mean all.
I did enjoy it, and, you know, it does shine a light on what a remarkable man he was from, you know, very, very underprivileged childhood. Right through to you know, American's ace of aces and then a successful businessman. Now, unfortunately, He suffers a stroke in 1972, and that left him in a coma for a short period.
Yeah, he does get better, but I don't think, from the sounds of it, properly better, because it's only a year later. So he's
spoiler.
Dead. Yeah, spoiler. So what does he do? July 73, he travels to Zurich. He's after medical treatment for his wife's failing vision. So still a caring, sharing type. Yeah. And what happens while he's in Zurich? It's a place to go for to recover from illnesses.
Yeah, he contracts pneumonia and he died at the age of 82.
That's a fair old age for a man who, when he was flying above France in 1918, he probably would have counted his life in hours rather than decades.
Yeah, and when he died, Rickenbacker was the last living Medal of Honor recipient from the United States Army Service, Army Air Service.
He still was. He was a great man, wasn't he?
He was.
There's a tragic side story in the fact, although it's his wife, Adelaide, what happens to her?
Well, she, as we mentioned, she was blind, in failing health, and she's still grieving severely from the loss of her husband. And in 1977... she shot herself at their home in Key Biscayne, Florida, at the age of 92.
That's a sad, sad ending for me. So basically, we've enjoyed doing it. We're going to do more American stuff because we've had a look at where our audience lies. And a lot of you are American. Hi. Sorry about the American accents. Gary's was great. We would urge you to our American friends. Laugh or Cry is now available in America land for a modest sum. And we're looking forward to carrying on into another year of podcasts. And actually, it's our third anniversary coming up in February, Gary.
Yeah, we're getting divorced soon.
No, Gary, we're looking forward to the prosperous and happy future.
Yeah. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blah, blah, 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 blah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?